the administration needs additional time to determine its response to the issues that are raised in the petition and the amicus brief.
The state asked the Alaska Supreme Court for more time in a case involving tribal adoptions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the price of going against caucus rules.
An opportunity to provide input into that budget was offered at every subcommittee level. And if you don't participate in the subcommittee level, if you don't talk to your committee chairs, you subvert your ability to do anything.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
The state today asked the Alaska Supreme Court for more time in a case involving the adoption of a Yupik child, a case that tribes say will determine how the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, will be implemented in Alaska and show whether Governor Bill Walker is serious about the campaign pledges he made to work cooperatively with tribes. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Under the terms of ICWA, Alaska Native children must be placed for adoption with their relatives or tribal members unless it's clearly in the child's interests to do otherwise. But an Alaska Supreme Court ruling last September allowed a non-Native couple to adopt a Native child after the Governor Sean Parnell administration successfully argued the child's Native grandmother failed to file a petition to adopt, a requirement the state contends was set by a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. But attorneys for the grandmother and the village of Tununuk maintain the grandmother's request to the state's Office of Children's Services and her court testimony stating she wanted to adopt her granddaughter meet the higher court standards. They say requiring a petition to adopt would create a costly barrier between Native children and Native families. They submitted a petition for a rehearing of the case, and the U.S. Department of Justice joined them with an advisory or amicus brief. Jacqueline Schaefer is an assistant attorney general in the Alaska Department of Law.
The state has requested an additional 30-day extension because the administration needs additional time to determine its response to the issues that are raised in the petition and the amicus brief.
Lloyd Miller of Sanosky Chambers Saxe Miller & Munson, who is representing the grandmother in the case, says he's encouraged the state has asked for more time.
This case is a potentially explosive case and could well define the administration's position in Alaska Native Affairs, and in particular, the relationship the administration is going to have with tribes in Alaska. So the more time the state takes to carefully consider what it's going to do, the better.
Miller says the Walker administration is right to carefully consider the larger implications of Tununuk versus Alaska.
So I think it's to the Attorney General's credit that he is now open to the possibility of taking a different position and sorting through whether or not to do so. I think that's very important, and that does take time.
It's now up to the Alaska Supreme Court to decide whether to grant the state a time extension. Schaefer says the state is working to make it easier for relatives and tribal members to adopt Native children.
Regardless of whether the state changes its position in this appeal, the state has already started down the path of finding ways to work with tribes to ease the adoption requirements and to improve OCS services to Alaska Native communities.
The state's request for an extension comes after the Alaska Federation of Natives and organizations like the Association of Village Council Presidents, Tanana Chiefs Conference, and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska last week asked the state to change its position. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Last week, Representative Laura Reinbold voted against the operating budget, breaking one of the House Majority Caucus rules for membership. Now the Eagle River Republican has lost her committee chairmanship and her seat on all but one committee. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The meeting to remove Representative Laura Reinbold of most of her power was short, under 5 minutes. While she was not in attendance, every member of House leadership was. Speaker Mike Chenault reassigned her positions in rapid succession.
Herron will replace Representative Reinbolt on the Rules Committee. Representative Tallarico will replace Representative Reinbolt on the Education Committee. Representative Vasquez is the new Vice Chairman of the Education Committee.
And so on. Reinbold lost her co-chairmanship of Military and Veterans Affairs. She was removed from every committee save for the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Members of her four-person staff will be dismissed. While Reinbold will get to keep her office through the legislative session, other members of the House Majority Caucus have already been asking about the space. Reinbold's offense was voting against a budget bill. She felt that the operating budget, which cut 10% in agency operations, did not go far enough.
I don't see the willpower to do that right now in a time of crises.
Reinbold says the vote she took was for her constituents, not the majority caucus. There are only two hard rules for membership to the legislature's majority caucuses. A member needs to support procedural moves like committee assignments, and a member needs to vote for whatever budget gets produced, even if they don't like aspects of it. Charisse Millett is the House Majority Leader, and she spent 2 years outside the caucus system before rejoining. She says that the point of the budget rule is basically to make sure a budget gets passed, instead of having fights break out over specific projects and line items.
We have finance members that work, 20 hours a day on formulating a good budget. An opportunity to provide input into that budget was offered at every subcommittee level. And if you don't participate in the subcommittee level, if you don't talk to your committee chairs, if you don't offer amendments, then you subvert your ability to do anything.
The last time a member was removed from the House majority for violating the budget rule was in 2005, when then-Representative Nancy Dahlstrom cast a no vote. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The heads of the two federal agencies in charge of offshore oil and gas drilling visited Alaska last week to discuss proposed safety regulations for drilling in the Arctic. They spoke with stakeholders in Anchorage and around the North Slope, including hosting a town hall meeting in Barrow. Brian Salerno is the director of the Interior Department's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. He says the rules set transparent, universal safety standards for drilling in the Arctic's outer continental shelf. Currently, safety plans are company and project specific.
What this rule does is set a standard of care whereby if you bring what you need with you into the region. So specific items like a same season relief rig is included in there. That's not required elsewhere because rigs are more readily available in the Gulf, for example.
Salerno says the proposal allows for some flexibility and for the use of new improved technologies. If more companies start working in the region, they can pool their equipment. He says it's unclear how much implementing the regulations will cost industry groups because there's so little data about working in the region. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Director Abigail Hopper says the rules include safety requirements for mobilization, demobilization, and transit of equipment as well. They also require an integrated operations plan that involves state and federal agencies.
I think it's in everyone's best interest, including industry, to have a clear path forward and clear rules and have the public have confidence that the regulators have sort of understand the unique characteristics.
Salerno and Hopper say the feedback they've received so far has been positive, though many stakeholders haven't had time to review the proposal in full. They're collecting comments until April 27th. The new rules, if adopted, would apply to both the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. The Secretary of Interior will issue a record of decision on Chukchi Lease Sale 193 by the end of March. The decision will determine if Shell can proceed with its drilling plans for the region this summer. Their leases have been suspended since 2014, pending the release of the new Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement that came out in February. Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement Director Salerno says he thinks the EIS will be accepted and Shell will be able to submit an exploration plan. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after an eighth homicide, Anchorage police maintain it's a spike, not a trend.
They're all high-risk type lifestyles that they're involved in. They all are associated with drugs or alcohol.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Dallas Seavey and Aaron Burmeister were the first two into Koyuk this afternoon. Seavey led by only 3 minutes, though his 50-mile run from Shaktulik was the fastest by far, only 7.5 hours. Ellie Zirkel and Jesse Royer arrived later in the afternoon. Emily Schwing is in Koyuk. Emily, winds picked up yesterday, but the temperature is less brutal than it has been for mushers. How is the weather impacting the race?
It's about 14 degrees above zero today here in Koyuk. The rest of the race, it's been as cold as 50 below. So this is a huge change. Yesterday when we left Caltech, it was 25 below. So that warm weather is kind of giving mushers a well-deserved break. It is a little warm for sled dogs with thick coats. But here in Koyuk in the dog yard, all the dogs of the four teams that are currently in, Allie Zirkel, Jesse Royer, Dallas Seavey, and Aaron Burmeister, all those dogs are kind of cashed out and having a bit of a rest.
So no one has a significant lead right now. Aaron Burmeister and Dallas Seavey arrived in Koyuk within minutes of each other. Jeff King, Jesse Royer, and Allie Zirkel were close behind them. What does this mean, all these teams so close together? How will this play out?
Yeah, so Allie Zirkel and Jesse Royer also arrived within minutes of each other, and it all depends on what is happening on the trail ahead. Aaron Burmeister broke trail through about 4 inches of snow here in Sequoyuk, which definitely sort of burned some of that energy his dog team had. Dallas Seavey got lucky and was able to take advantage of an already broken trail, but everybody coming in here today is saying that the run was long, slow, and they're trying to figure out what the game plan is from here, because there's probably more fresh snow on the trail. And with the way the wind had been last night, it's likely drifted in places. Although a local told me that it was not windy here at all in Koyuk overnight, just that the snow came down like crazy.
Emily, what do you think is yet to come as teams leave Koyuk for Villages and White Mountain?
Oh, I don't have a crystal ball. You know, that's a tough question to answer. We are looking at some tired dog teams. We are looking at some tired mushers. You know, it's real late in the race at this point. Weather-wise, there's fresh snow on the trail. We're on the coast, so it's likely to be windy. And with that fresh snow, we could see some ground blizzards. Things could get dramatic. They usually tend to. It is the Iditarod. But things could just kind of calm down and people could cruise to Nome. I don't think we'll know until we actually get to White Mountain and start looking at who's arriving and how they rest in that 8 hours.
All right, Emily, thank you so much for that update from Koyuk.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks a lot, Lori.
Since the start of the year, Anchorage has seen 8 homicides and a spat of shootings. Today, officials say the incidents in Alaska's largest city represent a spike, not an overall rise in violent crime. The press conference at City Hall was just hours after a stabbing victim was pronounced dead following an early morning dispute. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, the pronouncement is at odds with widespread concerns over public safety.
While the Anchorage Police Department can't point to any one cause, Deputy Chief Myron Fanning says in his 23 years on the force, he's seen waves of violent crime like this before.
Occasionally you'll have a spike, and sometimes we're able to identify the reason, sometimes not.
Fanning says a task force assembled in February made up of federal, state, and local agencies has made 26 arrests and solved all but one of the recent homicide cases. In the process, they've seized hard drugs like heroin and methamphetamine, 40 illegal guns, and $35,000 in cash. But Fanning says while there are similarities in the homicide cases, they aren't connected by any pattern.
I mean, like I said, they're all high-risk type lifestyles that they're involved in. They all are associated with drugs or alcohol. But, you know, I don't know why last January we had two and this January we had four. I don't know the answer to that. It just happens sometimes like that.
The task force continues investigating January's double homicide in East Anchorage. Mayor Dan Sullivan echoes the high-profile crimes being a blip rather than an upward trend. Looking at the data, Sullivan says it's important not to miss the forest for the trees, as Anchorage's five-year average for major crimes continues to fall.
There's fewer crimes reported in Anchorage, Alaska now than 30 years ago when we were 120,000 fewer people in this city. 2014, for example, we saw the lowest number of murders in 20 years in Anchorage. And we always caution folks when they see a spike in one activity or another that it doesn't really mean Anchorage has somehow become more dangerous. We look at trends, and the trend is very good.
That is a hard sell when concerns over public safety are emerging as the biggest political issue in this year's mayor's race. Sullivan's approach to staffing levels at APD has been controversial. 2 years worth of academies canceled during his tenure to curb spending have meant a smaller overall force. During a recent forum on public safety, all eight candidates in attendance agreed on the need for more police officers, although details on paying for them remain hazy. What to do with those officers is a trickier question. Sullivan says it's inaccurate to assume more police leads to less crime. In fact, he says, the numbers prove you can have an effective force just by apportioning man hours differently. According to Deputy Chief Fanning, a combination of flex time and using local partnerships helped the police department quickly make arrests without racking up overtime hours. What's less clear in the numbers is whether the resources are there to proactively have police out in Anchorage's neighborhoods before violence occurs. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Governor Bill Walker has named two Alaska fishermen to serve on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. The 11 voting member council manages most fisheries in federal waters. The terms of two Alaska members are due to expire this summer. Anchorage resident Dan Hall, who currently chairs the council, was selected for the small boat commercial representative seat. He fishes commercially for halibut, salmon, and other species. Seward resident Andy Mesereau was selected as the governor's choice for the seat intended for a recreational fishing representative. He would replace Ed Dersham. Mesereau is a charter operator who also fishes commercially for halibut.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Cruise lines that sail Alaska waters are installing new pollution control equipment. It's aimed at clearing the air and meeting new regulations, but it's also dodging some stronger, more expensive measures. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The stuff that comes out of cruise ship smokestacks can cloud the air, leaving a haze over port cities and plumes along their routes. But it's more than unsightly. Sulfur dioxide, ash, and other ingredients contribute to acid rain and smog. They can also cause respiratory problems and even death. That's why the Environmental Protection Agency set new emission standards for most vessels. That includes almost 30 large cruise ships sailing Alaska waters, some of which are getting new pollution control equipment.
One of the ships, which is the Solstice, is being retrofitted right now.
Rich Pruitt is Vice President of Environmental Stewardship for Royal Caribbean International, which will send 5 ships to Alaska this summer. He says about 20 of its vessels, close to half its worldwide fleet, are getting air emission control equipment called scrubbers.
By spraying water into the exhaust stream, the sulfur dioxide and particulate are basically captured in the water spray, and it effectively removes any sulfur dioxide, you know, up to about 98-99%, and a significant portion of the particulate.
He says the rest of the corporation's fleet will eventually get the technology, though it may try some other options. The cruise industry could meet EPA standards and upcoming international rules by switching to low sulfur fuel, which causes far less pollution. Pruitt says that's too expensive, and refineries may not be able to keep up with the demand. That's why the industry is installing scrubbers.
We're looking at this as a way of, you know, ensuring that we'll be able to be compliant regardless of where we operate.
Royal Caribbean is one of several worldwide lines installing scrubber technology. Carnival Corporation, which also owns Princess and Holland America lines, announced its intentions in 2013.
The only other major cruise line that brings ships to Alaska is Norwegian Cruise Lines, and they also have a program to start to install scrubbers on their existing ships.
John Binkley is president of the Alaska chapter of the Cruise Lines International Association. The new federal rules took effect in January, but Binkley says most ships weren't ready.
Each company has negotiated with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, on a schedule and when they're going to bring certain ships into compliance.
Critics say the line should have been ready sooner. Chip Toma campaigned for a tax and pollution control initiative voters approved about 10 years ago.
The cruise lines fought that tooth and nail in the State Department and every chance they get in Washington, D.C. to try to scuttle that treaty.
He's encouraged by the new scrubber technology, but he says the line should also switch to low-sulfur diesel.
I think that the price of fuel, all fuel, is going to keep going down, and it's eventually going to be in everybody's best interest to just burn clean fuel.
Some critics say scrubbers only change air pollution into ocean pollution since the filtered water is disposed of overboard. Pruitt says Royal Caribbean ships, which include the Celebrity line, will treat the water and dispose of the resulting sludge on land. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
The Juneau Public Library System embarks on an oral history project this spring, collecting Alaska Native stories on educational experiences. The capital city's library is one of 10 picked from more than 300 national applicants to bring StoryCorps to the community. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Freda Westman is a product of Juneau's public school system, a 1974 graduate of Juneau Douglas High School. Westman is grand president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood. One of her strongest childhood memories is from when she was in middle school.
I asked a teacher at the end of the year why my grade was a C, and could we go and look at the grade book? And we did and averaged it out, and my grade was really a B, and so it was changed.
At the time, she learned that teachers, who she greatly respected, could make mistakes, and those mistakes could be fixed. She learned the value of standing up for herself. Now, Westman looks back at that situation and realizes those types of errors were likely made on a regular basis.
Expectations for Alaska Native students were low, so maybe that was a motivation.
Westman's mother stopped going to school in the eighth grade to care for ailing family members.
She was not allowed to speak Tlingit in school and was not only not allowed to do that, but was punished for doing that. She told us that that is why she didn't want to teach us Tlingit. She didn't want us to experience that.
These are just a couple of memories that exist in Juneau's Alaska Native community, stories that the public library hopes to capture through StoryCorps interviews. StoryCorps is a national oral history project based in Brooklyn, New York. You've likely heard snippets of StoryCorps interviews on National Public Radio. Librarian Andrea Hirsch says the interviews aren't formal. It's a conversation between two people.
A lot of people pick a family member, a grandparent, a child, a sibling, a neighbor, and they tell their story.
The theme of Alaska Native educational experiences sprang from an issue that took place last year concerning the Juneau School District's elementary language arts curriculum. Community members raised concerns about school texts depicting Alaska Native and Native American tragedies, including the boarding school experience in Alaska. The texts were called distorted, inaccurate, and insensitive. the district eventually decided to remove the controversial texts and replace them with locally developed materials. The superintendent invited Alaska Native community members into the classroom to tell their stories. Library program coordinator Beth Weigel hopes the StoryCorps project can help fulfill this need and others.
Oral history is a big part of the Alaska Native tradition, so if we have it available, then those are available to teachers if they want to use those as part of the resource materials in their classroom, and there'll be stories by Alaska Natives, their stories that they tell in their own words.
Before applying for the library grant, Weigel and Hirsch sought advice and support from members of the Alaska Native community in Juneau, like Sorrel Goodwin. Goodwin is a librarian at the Alaska State Library. He says the project is an opportunity to get Alaska Native perspectives on the American educational system. In the mid-1990s, Goodwin interviewed Alaska Natives on that topic for a teaching course at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Most of their perspectives were largely negative, dealing with such issues as racism and assimilation and the sort of, you know, degradation of Alaska Native cultures, languages, histories, going right on into flat-out physical, mental, and sexual abuse in many of the boarding school contexts.
Goodwin hopes the library's project will include interviews of the younger generation, Alaska Natives who are currently going through the educational system.
A lot of our parents and grandparents' negative experiences in the American education system have been carried forward. It created a sort of intergenerational post-traumatic stress in the ways that many of our people are either able to engage or not engage with the dominant society system of educating people.
Sorrel says the more stories that are told, the more understanding will take place. He thinks the StoryCorps project can help the community work through issues that still remain. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, and Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez also reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University offers working professionals courses designed to fit their busy lifestyles. With hybrid online and in-person classes, the MBA at APU is an accelerated, affordable, and high-quality pathway to career advancement. Learn more by calling 800-252-7528 or visiting alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, human resources, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.